This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You want to feel powerful, you little sicko Nazi hippies? Feel powerful, you murdering scum.
So in that spirit, I'm announcing a new contest. It's called Arrest the Climatologists.
Should we arrest our best climate scientist? Talk about shooting the messenger. The denier fringe is calling for investigations and criminal charges. On today's Radio EcoShock show, you'll hear one of the world's top scientists answer those charges. I'll digest the best from a stunning speech by Professor Richard B. Alley at the American Geophysical Union annual meeting in San Francisco in December. But first, despite an almost normal winter in the Northern Hemisphere, ski operators and enthusiasts are wondering if climate change will end winter sports as we know them. We go straight to Aspen, Colorado to find out more. Ten years ago, the tipping point was whether we could stop climate change. Now, in my opinion, after years of inaction, the answer is no, we can only modify it. The next tipping point could be in human affairs, namely, will we be able to govern ourselves? Will our civilization survive the coming climate panic? The coming climate panic, that's the title of a work just ricocheted all over the blogosphere. Let's meet the author, Auden Schendler. Auden, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the heavy talk, can you explain what you do for a living?
I'm the sustainability director at a ski resort in Colorado, and the short story is my job is to address the environmental impacts of the company and reduce them. And we've found that the biggest environmental threat to our business is climate change, so we've had a philosophy over the last few years now of trying to find our biggest levers to address climate change.
And you know, I first heard you on radio back in 2006. The interview was done by Betsy Rosenberg, the former Air America host for EcoTalk, and that was the nation's only daily green radio program at the time. And you were outlining all the ways the Aspen Ski Company has been going towards sustainability. And I did my own podcast right then called Will There Be Winter Sports? And you should have seen the avalanche of downloads. Apparently a lot of people still want a winter. Are you finding that?
Yeah, and in some ways that's our philosophy, is that climate change isn't something that the average person can really understand. And this isn't being condescending. It's complex science. And people's eyes glaze over when you start mentioning parts per million of atmospheric CO2. But people can relate to the idea of something they love and care about going away. And it's surprising how many people, I think it's 57 million people, love skiing and care about it and go every year.
I phoned up our local hill, the site of the 2010 Winter Olympic Games, Whistler Blackcomb, and I was expecting some double talk on global warming, but not at all. They were totally aware of climate change and trying to push for action to save their snow and their business. You know, we have plenty of snow this year, but the biggest worry for the Winter Olympics is fog. That could cause cancellation of some events, and it could be, you know, if things just get too warm for the snow that they've got.
Yeah, I think the coastal resorts are, and Whistler in particular, are pretty well aware of climate, because the coastal areas probably will see earlier effects as a result of warming. So they're well aware of these issues. And the ski industry as a whole has gone from not really caring or not wanting to care to being fairly progressive on this issue.
From Colorado, we're talking with Auden Schendler. He's the author of a new book, Getting Green Done, Hard Truths from the Front Lines of the Sustainability Revolution. Now he's stirred up a hornet's nest of net talk, saying we could be setting ourselves up for the coming climate panic. Why do you say that, Auden, and why now?
Well, I think the idea is that Mark Trexler and I put forward, and Mark is a warrior in the world of climate science and policy. The idea is that we have a distinct problem out there that there's really no doubt about. It's already happening, climate change. And yet there's indolence on the part of government and corporations, for the most part, in addressing it. And at some point, there's going to be a tipping point or a break where the public says, hey, this is absurd. We're going to have to move here. And they're going to cause rapid policy change to happen in the short term. And this is going to be a shock. It's going to be like revolutions we've seen in the past. And you see this kind of magma bubble of discontent happening. You've got Nobel Prize winners, economists, scientists in a state of panic about the climate science.
Well, what do you think it would take to move most Americans into a demand for rapid action on climate?
I think it's going to take some discrete climate event. And that's unfortunate because if you look right now, people say, well, it's cold. And actually, it has been cold in North America. The decade, this recent decade, was the hottest ever. But North America over the last year has been pretty cold. So people say, oh, well, climate's not happening. Well, if you had the reverse, where you had big warmth, big droughts, you know, something like the European scale heat waves, maybe that would get people's attention. This would be unfortunate because it would be painful, but it's unclear how else we're going to change public opinion on this subject. And an interesting point that Joe Rome has made on his Climate Progress blog and that we make in our article too is that one of the reasons not to take action on climate is people say, well, it'll bankrupt the country. So we don't want government action. But if you wait and don't have government action on climate, if you wait 10 or 20 years, you're going to have overwhelming government response. So it's in a way the conservatives who oppose government intervention are going to bring it on exponentially more powerfully than if we did it today by delaying.
Right. So if you don't want big government, maybe we can start incrementally switching to sustainable energy instead of waiting till everybody wants it all of a sudden.
If you don't want big government, solve climate now using government.
Wow. Well, nobody knows the future, of course, but let's game out that scenario a little bit. A sudden realization on the public about the seriousness of the climate threat. How do you think that could play out? What would people do?
Well, Trexler and I think that one way this plays out is that you have a massive public opinion shift that forces politicians, elected officials, into implementing aggressive policy. So as an example, you could have an overnight ban on coal-fired power plants. This is almost a de facto situation in the U.S. anyway. It's very hard to build or finance a coal-fired power plant because they're clearly going to be out of business soon. We can't, unless we can capture the CO2, we can't keep building them. But if that happened overnight, that influences utilities. That changes how we think about energy. You know, another thing that could happen is there could be implementation of a progressive tax or cap and trade on carbon where the price of energy goes up and maybe the price of other things goes down. But if you see a rapid increase in energy, that has a shock effect on our economies, as we know from the oil price spike. So we're saying there could be economic disruption as a result of rapid policy change, which itself would be resulting from essentially a public outcry or a revolution.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Auden Schindler, let me run an idea by you. Right now, listeners should find out where their power comes from. If it's from coal, they either move right now or commit themselves to 3 years to trying to get sustainable energy in their region. And if that fails, then you move to somewhere with more hydro or wind or solar power. Because my take is that new industry is not going to locate anywhere that is totally dependent on coal. Coal isn't reliable because of what we're talking about. It could be shut down quickly if there was a climate panic. What do you think of that?
Well, I agree with you that it makes no sense for anyone, utility or community or business, to depend on coal because it's just a huge risk. It's a business risk. Forget climate. It's just pure business. It's going to be really expensive to run these plants. I don't think the answer is to move because only 2%, no, not 2%, even less than 2% of the U.S. is running on renewable power. So there's nowhere to go. But the answer is to get engaged with who produces your power and influence them. And that means running for the board of your utility or getting in touch with your utility or getting citizen groups together and getting municipal governments together and saying, we got to have more clean power. Moving, though, isn't going to help, because you're going to move to a place that puts you in the same situation you were before.
Well, one concern I have is this. There may be a time of panic, but people may not realize exactly what's causing it. I mean, suppose we have a creeping economic decline with energy prices going ever higher and lots of social problems and a couple of climate hits. Will we know the role of climate disruption, or will the scientific signal be lost amid the noise of a lot of other problems that seem more familiar?
I mean, that's a concern. And I don't think it would be in terms of high energy prices, because a lot of people believe that you can get unlimited clean energy at 15 cents a kilowatt hour. But I think you could start seeing the creeping economic impacts of climate change and not put two and two together. Droughts and floods and wells becoming saline in places like Bangladesh and all these things that create economic and social disruption that are what climate models say we'll see, but we haven't put it all together. And that's the concern. I mean, essentially what I'm saying is that the economic cost of not doing anything on climate far exceeds the cost of doing something. And that is really the bigger concern, I think, about climate change is we're going to see disrupted economies as a result of this unless we get moving on it.
Auden Schindler, your article, The Coming Climate Panic, was reprinted all over the blogosphere, from the big ones like Grist and Salon to 1,000 personal blogs. I suppose that's no big surprise since you've been published in all kinds of mainstream media as well. But this article generated thousands of responses in the comments sections. Why do you think it was so widely published?
You know, you never know why a certain thing catches fire on the blogosphere, but I think this taps a latent idea or fear in the public mind, which is climate change has become obvious to most people and certainly everyone in the scientific community, and yet we're not doing anything on it. And it becomes the source of the same kind of seed that has fueled revolutions. At some point, people are just going to be fed up. And you know, you and I are fed up. What happens when the same number of people who got fed up with immigration policy get out on the streets in L.A.? Or what if you have a civil rights scale demonstration in Washington on this? That's going to cause rapid change. I don't think that's too far off the kinds of mass public movement we saw around civil rights.
Well, sure, let's get paranoid for a minute. Isn't it possible a climate panic could bring political instability to Western democracies?
I think climate change as a whole can be politically disruptive. If you look at countries that are in danger of falling apart from climate impacts, I mean, Africa's an example of that, is seeing climate impacts and is also going to suffer from drought and starvation and war as a result of climate. The Pentagon's talked about the concerns about conflict over water as a result of climate change. I don't think Western government is in danger. I think we're too solid to see that. But upheaval, sure, and we've seen it before. I think the U.S. in particular is uniquely nimble and capable of dealing with that kind of change.
We could get some unintended consequences, though. We've seen the Conservative Party in Britain talk about big climate action, and we could elect almost anybody and get some unwanted side effects. That happened here in British Columbia. We got a carbon tax, sure, but the really very capitalist head of government also sold off the rights to our rivers for 30 years to big corporations for peanuts. I'm worried the public may rush from side to side if they perceive that it's a sinking boat.
You know, so little happens rapidly in government. I'm not too sure I'm scared of that. And I also think we've thought about this issue so deeply, or at least a lot of people in the policy world really understand how we need to go after this problem, that I don't see a lot of wacky solutions coming in. I think if policy is enacted rapidly, it'll probably be good policy. I mean, we have... even though the proposed cap and trade bill from the Senate is weak, it's still generally headed in the right direction.
I'm going to disagree with you on that, along with James Hansen. I feel that cap and trade is open to too many abuses. I personally would prefer to see a carbon tax. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would too, but we dwell in the real world, and a carbon tax ain't what's for dinner. You're just not going to pass it. You have to accept cap and trade. And a lot of really savvy people, like David Hawkins at the Natural Resources Defense Council, Joe Rome on climateprogress.org, they are recognizing this. Yeah, in a perfect world, Jim Hansen's right. Tax or fee and dividend makes a lot of sense. But we have to, you know, right now we have a Congress where 40 members of Congress don't want anything to pass in the U.S. So you have to be a political realist here. And even if, you know, I understand Hansen says, well, we won't solve the problem and we face catastrophe. Yeah, but that's all we're going to get is cap and trade.
Wow, what a tough problem. And another thing that I worry about, being a bit of a paranoid person, is that the government, let's say we have a big civil rights movement on climate and we get millions of people in the streets, there could be a time of repression where you get martial law to protect the coal plants and the refineries and the system as it is. I suppose you don't see that?
I don't think so. I mean, the U.S., not in the U.S., that I have too much faith in the power, the strength of our democracy, even though it may not look that strong right now.
Well, events so far have proven you right and me wrong. Have you thought about our personal responses? What can you and I do to prepare for a possible sudden realization by the public about climate change?
Well, the point of Mark Trexler and my article was that business needs to rethink this. They need to say, look, one scenario we might see is rapid change. As individuals, you know, I don't think this has as much of a dire impact. I think the role of individuals is to, frankly, force this change by being politically active and by recognizing that personal action, unless it's at a political scale, is no longer relevant on climate because we have too big a problem in too short a time. We have to look for a political lever here.
The coming climate panic sounds like the title of a new book. Are you considering that?
I just wrote a book, so I'm still recovering. So short answer, no.
Can you tell us about the book you did write?
Yeah, if you look at the sustainability world, everywhere you go and every book you read on sustainability, particularly business sustainability, is about the successes and how to build green and how green companies are better and more profitable. And nobody talks about the fact that not only is sustainability brutally difficult, but when you try to do these green buildings or green businesses or what have you, or even simple lighting retrofits, you run into this host of unbelievable obstacles and no one talks about it. We don't learn to hit a curveball by hitting it. We learn by missing. We have to share our mistakes. We have to talk about the challenges. We have to be honest about what matters and what doesn't. And I felt that the media and authors and experts and gurus weren't being honest. So I wrote Getting Green Done, which is sort of a peek under the rock of sustainability and the reality of what it means to make it happen. And the point is, we need this discussion. And the idea of the book is that it's fun, it's interesting. If you're in this field or not, you can relate to the challenges. And by understanding the challenges, you can overcome them and not make the same mistakes that I made, for example.
Is there a website or a blog where people can find out more about you?
Yeah, gettinggreendone.com is my book website, and it links to my blog and Twitter and Facebook. So it's a good place to go.
All right. This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Auden Schendler, Executive Director of Sustainability at Aspen Skiing Company. Before that, he was with the Rocky Mountain Institute. He's an outdoorsman who can think and write, including his latest book, Getting Green Done, Hard Truths from the Front Lines of the Sustainability Revolution. Auden, thank you so much for stirring up this much-needed public discussion.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for your radio show.
I'm Alex Smith. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I appreciate Auden Schendler's bravery putting out an SOS about delaying climate action. As I said, I disagree that cap and trade will actually save the planet. It's got corruption and cheating built right in my opinion, and in the European experience. A carbon tax flows through to the citizens, as proposed by Dr. James Hansen and others, and it has a chance of actually working. I also can't agree that the individual doesn't matter in this fight. Auden still believes governments are the right arena to solve this problem. Copenhagen and the simple record of increasing emissions no matter who is in government is, well, it's saying otherwise. Sure, we should push governments, but I've consistently said that you and I, the citizens, are the front line in the fight against climate change. After all, we're the ones using up all that oil and coal and fuel. We can and must. 1. Lead by example, cutting our own carbon emissions by at least 40% this year and pointing towards energy self-sufficiency in the long term. And no cheating with phony carbon offsets. 2. Start connecting and organizing locally. Fossil energy supplies are limited, and we can't burn what we do have. A local economy is the only way to survive well, in my opinion, or maybe to survive at all. Pay special attention to your food supplies. 3. Prepare for emergencies. There are tough, unstable times ahead. Have at least several weeks of food and water on hand, plus other supplies to keep warm and safe, and prepare to help others in emergencies. 4. Either dedicate hours a day to fight for sustainable energy in your community or figure out where to move. Pure coal power won't last the decade. Industry won't locate there. Eventually, consumers will demand labeling not just about the contents of products, but the amount of pollution used to produce it. 5. My last point, as an individual, is not to count on big governments for much at all. At every level, governments in North America, England, and some European countries, they're really bankrupt. The growth economy is sputtering out its last. Then we have to go for a stable state economy or massive reductions until the climate is stable and until a more just distribution of wealth is achieved. In his blog this week, the dour James Howard Kunstler writes, quote, "Our destination is an everyday economy where you rarely travel far from the place you live, where you have to make provision for your own health, your own old age, your own income, your own diet, your own security, and your own education. If you're really fortunate, some or all of these necessities can be obtained in conjunction with your neighbors in the place where you live, but don't expect an increasingly mythical federal government to supply any of it. Expect a new and different way of organizing households, based on extended families and kinship groups. Be prepared for agriculture to return to the foreground of everyday life, where farming is at the center of the economy. Think about how you will cultivate your best role in a social network so the things you do will be truly valued by the other people who know you." End quote. Find that under The Feudal Economy, January 4th, 2010, at Kunstler.com. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Look, it's winter. There is snow. It's going to be cold. I can't believe the number of idiots who cite that as proof of the coming ice age, much less a damnation of all climate science. If we are really that stupid, and some of us are, all future climate conferences have to be held in August, I guess. I believe the next one comes up in May 2010 in Germany. Climate is measured over decades at best. Heaven help us, if we have two real winters in a row, the masses may give in to the loudmouth deniers going back to energy gluttony while supplies last, and then we're doomed. What the heck? Let's get back to skiing. Joe Rome, the climate demigod blogger at climateprogress.org, has a feature on the future of skiing this week. Published January 6, 2010, it's called "Can U.S. Skiing Be Saved?" In the blog, a guest writes, "Take Aspen, for example. The resort is already seeing a gradual increase in frost-free days and warmer nights, according to Mike Kaplan, CEO of Aspen Skiing Company. And aspen trees are dying off in large numbers. A study by the Aspen Global Change Institute forecasts that if global carbon emissions continue to rise, aspen will warm by 14 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of this century, giving it a feel similar to Amarillo, Texas." End quote. Ouch. I started covering this story back in 2006 with a podcast called "Can Winter Sports Be Saved?" That MP3 got thousands of downloads and still goes out by the hundreds every month. In it, I interviewed a rep from Whistler Blackcomb, the super Canadian ski resort where 2010 Olympic downhill events will be held in February. Not much has changed since then, except emissions are worse and the climate warmed faster. Let's give it a listen now. So what about Whistler Blackcomb and the upcoming Olympics? Earlier, before he headed out onto the hills, I spoke to Arthur DeJong, who's been the ski patrol manager and the operations manager, and now he's the mountain planning and environment resource manager for Whistler Blackcomb.
This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, and I've been listening to radio reports from the United States, in particular an interview with a gentleman who runs the Aspen Complex, talking about his concerns about climate change and about the availability of snow in the future for ski resorts. And at the same time, as we know in Europe, a couple of the World Cup ski races have been canceled due to lack of snow and an unusual season over there. So I was going to ask you about Whistler Blackcomb's policy on climate change. What are your feelings? Do you think this is going to affect the ski industry?
Well, certainly, I guess to give the macro or big picture perspective, if I was having coffee with Kofi Annan this morning and asked him, of the UN, what are the two most important things to focus on with respect to sustainability? His answer would probably be, well, let's first try to resolve global poverty, and number two, we'd better do something about climate change, or the world as we know it will likely be considerably different by mid-century. So we take climate change very, very seriously here at Whistler. This isn't something that's new on our agenda. Glaciers, which we have a number of surrounding the Whistler Blackcomb area, have been receding for over a century. And glaciers are the most sensitive ecosystem to temperature change. Essentially, they're nature's thermometer. So we've known for a long time that the climate has been warming, and consequently, we've been developing programs to both mitigate and adapt to climate change. So we've been preparing for this for several decades.
And I understand just from looking at your website that you've been undertaking some efforts to hold on to a glacier or two that you've got already?
That's correct. Horseman Glacier, which is part of our summer operations, believe it or not, we're skiing up to 10 months a year here. The Horseman Glacier has been receding like other glaciers in the area, and we've actually engineered. We have yet to be put in a position where we have to do it, but we have engineered a snowmaking system that would feed the accumulation zone or the top of the glacier to a degree that we could actually grow the glacier should we be required to. And one of the inputs we'd love to put into that system is to power it through wind generation, so essentially we can close the loop and it's a completely sustainable operation growing back a glacier. That's a bit of a science project. The bigger picture is, again, that climate change is here, and we need to do a number of actions to ensure our long-term viability as a ski area. So we've been investing considerable money into snowmaking, particularly at our lower elevations. That's where we are vulnerable. And over the next 3 years, we'll be spending over $25 million on snowmaking, and again, principally focused on the lower elevations. In terms of development, we've been placing our lifts more into our higher elevations. Despite the Whistler Valley being quite low in elevation, over 50% of Whistler Blackcomb's terrain is above treeline, above 5,500 feet. So we have a lot of opportunity to move more of our lifts into what we call the snow belt, and even 20, 30 years from now, there'll still be very significant snowpacks at those elevations. The third thing that we are focused on with respect to adapting to climate change, because we as a company cannot change the course of climate change, but we need to do our part in terms of mitigating, but again, adapting. We spend a lot of time in the summers doing what we call summer grooming, essentially making our ski runs, trails, flatter, profiling it in a way that we only require, let's say, 30 centimeters of snow to open a trail as opposed to a meter.
And one other thing they mentioned at Aspen is that they're actually now letting their guests know that climate change is upon us, and they're setting up a Save the Snow website, I believe. And you do have some powerful and influential people come skiing at your resort as well. Are you going to let people know about climate change through the skiing experience?
Absolutely. We already are. Being that we have glaciers within our operating area and surrounding us, it's the best testimony. A picture is 1,000 words, and we can show our guests look at what climate change is doing, when we can show what the size of a glacier 30 years ago and the size of what it is today and in its reduced footprint, that's when the light's turned on. So we have this opportunity to be an advocate of enactment for climate change. But I think what is most important for Whistler Blackcomb is that we first show our guests, our community, and society at large what is possible in terms of reducing our fossil footprint. So we have a number of programs where we are what we call grabbing the low-hanging fruit, just simply changing our light bulbs to energy-efficient bulbs, putting timer sensors through all our facilities so we're only using energy when we need it, using the most fuel-efficient engines on our snow grooming fleet. We've been able to, just with good European Mercedes technology, we've reduced our fossil fuel consumption by 18% on all our snow grooming cats. And there's a number of technologies out there today that can help us reduce our footprint. And I think that's the best way of addressing the issue to the guest, is making them aware of the issues, but also showing that change is possible. So we need to be not only an educator, but a change agent.
You were telling me you have a couple of micro-generating projects going.
This is very important to us because we want to show other companies and society that it's possible to turn a corner quick on using cleaner energy. So we are working on a wind farm. At this point, we're just putting MET towers up to the meteorological towers to verify whether we have the wind supply available to economically be able to build a wind farm. One project that's much closer to reality is a micro hydro project in a river called the Fitzsimmons, which essentially flows between Whistler and Blackcomb. And it has the power availability, or the water supply rather, to produce what we consume as an operation. So it's about an $18 million project. It produces about 32 gigawatts annually. And that could happen within 18 months. The engineering is already in place. It is viable. So if we're able to bring that project to fruition, we're really demonstrating to our guest and to our community and society that a company, an operation, can quickly become sustainable within its own operating footprint. So we're excited about that. We certainly have some work ahead to get that done.
Well, that's the way we all have to go. And finally, I guess the big question on everyone's lips in the lower mainland area is, will there be snow for the 2010 Winter Olympics?
Absolutely, absolutely. Climate change, like science, is based on long-term trends. If you look at Whistler today, it looks like mid-January here, we're at about 1.7 meters of snowpack, but that's weather. The science, in terms of what the global science community has told us, is that the real threats are long-term, and by mid-century, unless society at large makes significant changes in our consumption behavior with fossil fuels, that's when we as a global community really start to run into trouble. And that's quite a ways out. The Olympics are 3 years away, so we're in good shape there.
So keep on skiing.
Keep on skiing.
All right. Well, thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's been my pleasure.
That was an interview from one of my early Radio EcoShock podcasts in 2006. Find all our past programs and features as free MP3 downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock, like an electric shock, .org. In the recent attacks on top scientists, let us take the case of Richard B. Alley. He is the Evan Pugh Professor of Geosciences at Penn State University. Alley is a fellow of the American Geophysical Union and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. His popular book about ice cores is called The 2 Mile Time Machine. Alley was expected to give one of the best speeches of 2009 at the annual general meeting at the AGU, and he did not disappoint. I'm Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, and I'm going to give you a short digest of that hour-long Bjerkny lecture to the AGU in San Francisco in December. Professor Alley begins with the attack.
Now, this is where I said these are interesting times. Okay, this is a copy of an email that was sent to my administration by an alum. And said alum copied me on this, so I believe I am fair. The alum asked for certain personnel changes to be made, and I have just put in the ones that relate to me. So for what it's worth, Dr. Alley's work on CO2 levels in ice cores. Now, I don't actually do that, but I talk about it. Okay, Dr. Alley's work about CO2 levels in ice cores has confirmed that CO2 lags Earth's temperature. This one scientific fact alone proves that CO2 is not the cause of the recent warming. I continue to mislead the scientific community. There should be prompt response, getting rid of me. I have crimes against the scientific community, Penn State, the citizens of this great country, and the citizens of the world that must be dealt with severely because of my shameful activities. So there'll be a wanted poster up here somewhere. But the thing which is fascinating, and we'll come back to, is that this email has in it a logical fallacy which is evident on casual observation. And I think it's worth our understanding at some level how polarized the world is, how easy it is for someone to misunderstand our science if they aren't fully within it, the amount of education, the amount of outreach, the amount of clarification that we have to make to get from this to a proper scientific understanding.
Later in this program, we'll follow Professor Alley as he explains the denialist bugaboo of carbon dioxide lagging temperatures as they rise in climate history. In excerpts from this important speech, we'll learn more about the scientific history of our planet and its atmosphere, the place where we live. Penn State's Professor Richard B. Alley received an award for his work teaching the history of Earth's past climates, and he gave this speech at the December 2009 meeting in San Francisco. The title of the speech was "The Biggest Control Knob, Carbon Dioxide in Earth's Climate History." The entire speech with an accompanying slide can be seen in a 57-minute video, and I've given you the link to it in my blog entry for January 7, 2010. Find that at ecoshock.org. The first 20 minutes of Alley's speech goes into the many ways that scientists can measure past CO2 levels. These include actual air samples trapped in ice cores, plus a whole range of cross-checking available from seabed analysis, shells of creatures, the way leaves are disformed, or even the teeth of some mammals. It's a list of techniques too long to list here. Please listen to the speech. Dr. Alley explains, with graphs, the rock weathering thermostat that operates over long periods of time to balance both the CO2 and the temperature on our planet Earth. Dr. Alley tells us about the coldest times labeled Snowball Earth, but we begin our radio coverage with an event that must concern us all. 250 million years ago, there was a massive extinction called the Great Dying.
Right, 251 million years ago, basically almost every critter on the planet dies. The Great Dying, the end Permian extinction, maybe 95% of the species go, but because you can keep a species alive with a reasonably small number of individuals, this is really nasty, okay? And it turns out that there are bugs in the ocean, green sulfur bacteria, that use hydrogen sulfide rather than water in their photosynthesis. And they have very interesting biomarkers. And those biomarkers are found widespread at the time of the dying. And these things are living in the photic zone of the ocean, and they're living on hydrogen sulfide, which means that the ocean's surface is full of hydrogen sulfide. And if you breathe very much hydrogen sulfide, you die. And it's probable that that was true for a whole lot of oxygen-breathing critters back in the past. And so sometime here, the ocean gets full of hydrogen. It runs out of oxygen, and then it gets euxinic, and it fills up with hydrogen sulfide, and then it kills off most stuff on the planet. And it turns out that that happens to be a warm time. There's a big warming coming up to that. And the warming seems to have been because there was a big volcanism.
This is the theory popularized in the book Under a Green Sky by Peter Ward. Listen to our Radio EcoShock interviews with Dr. Peter Ward, especially the Under a Green Sky interview in September 12, 2008, and then his later explanation, the Medea Hypothesis, in the October 10, 2009 Radio EcoShock show. Isn't it important to know the worst-case climate scenario and how it developed, if that explains how rampant warming could kill off 95% of life here on Earth? We know that Earth has experienced extreme warming, where crocodiles played in tropical seas at the poles.
Now, come a little farther forward in time. We're now in the Saurian sauna of the mid-Cretaceous. It's still hot. There's no ice near sea level at the poles anywhere. You have balmy temperatures. You have forests crowding up to the edge of the Arctic Ocean. The continents are not that different from now. And if you put them in a model, as has been done, you know, you melt all the ice and the sea level gets a little higher and that changes the planet's albedo a little and you get a little bit of warming and you move the currents around and you might a little bit of warming with some configurations. You can't get much. And so it's really stinking hot. And the only explanation we can find on this is that CO2 is really high again. And probably, again, because volcanism is running pretty fast. If you put high CO2 in the models, you sort of match what happened, except that the world seems a little bit too warm at the poles. If you leave the CO2 out of the models, you don't get very close. The only way we can attribute this warmth of having an ice-free world is to have a high CO2.
But let's look at another horror example from Earth's past climate shifts. This is the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, something that looks possible for us even today.
And that's a very interesting little blip. It's where the Paleocene meets the Eocene, and it is a thermal maximum. So we call it the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. Geologists are fairly literal sometimes. Okay, what do we find there? There's a big isotopic anomaly that it says CO2, CO2, CO2. Maybe starting as methane, but going to CO2, okay? There's a big temperature change. The whole world is already hot, and it cranks up a few degrees C in a fairly short order. The ocean acidifies, and all the shells on the seafloor are dissolving, and there's a big extinction event of things that live on the seafloor. Pretty much all the ecosystems get kicked around. There's huge migrations. There seems to be the start of some evolution going on. There's a lot of ecosystem disruption. Things get out of place and out of time, as it were. You can't possibly blame this on drifting continents. It rises in a few thousand years, and it falls in a few tens of thousands, 100,000 years. So this is not a drifting continent thing. It's the CO2 shows up, and it gets hot, and it's fast compared to other things. And the way that it recovers looks just like our carbon cycle models. It's beautiful.
Allie continues with a detailed timeline of Earth's temperatures, showing a direct correlation between CO2 and temperature periods. The measurements, again, are amazing for their breadth, running from soil and sea samples to fossil teeth to leaf damage and fossil leaves, the work of scientists all over the world over decades. Boom, the CO2 goes up, and boom, so does the temperature, like dancing partners. There were times that didn't seem to fit beyond the meteorite hit. But, says Allie, in the last decades, almost all of these have been reasonably explained, and most turned out to be CO2-related after all. At the 40-minute mark in the talk, Richard Allie goes into the science discounting other theories of climate disruption, such as volcanoes or the influence of the sun. Of course, there are many factors in this complex system, and volcanoes and the sun, among others, do matter. But myriads of scientific studies show they are not the control knob when it comes to climate. CO2 is. One theory, which still needs more research, is this.
This one is important to carry home. People say, oh, wait a minute, the sun doesn't change much, but the sun modulates the cosmic rays modulate the clouds modulate the temperature, and so the sun is amplified hugely.
I believe this is the main theory from dissenting University of Alabama scientist Roy W. Spencer. He's coming out with two new books from the conservative publisher Encounter Books titled climate confusion, how global warming hysteria leads to bad science, pandering politicians, and misguided policies that hurt the poor. That'll come out in January 2010, followed just 2 months later by another book called The Great Global Warming Blunder, How Mother Nature Fooled the World's Top Climate Scientists in March 2010. A barrage of denial of human-induced climate change and a comfort to fossil fuel producers and users everywhere. Ali says of this theory,
it's really interesting hypothesis. There's really good science to be done on this. But we have reason to think it's a fine-tuning knob. Because this record, this is 60,000 years ago on the left up to today, and this is a record that is beryllium-10 in the ice core, and the beryllium-10 is made by cosmic rays. Now, the sun modulates cosmic rays, so do the magnetic field. And 40,000 years ago, the magnetic field basically zeroed out in what we call the Lachance anomaly for a millennium or so. And when it did, the cosmic rays came screaming into the Earth system, and you see in basically all sedimentary records this peak in cosmic ray-produced nuclides. We had a big cosmic ray signal, and the climate ignores it. And it's just about that simple. These cosmic rays didn't do enough that you can see it. So it's a fine-tuning knob at best for this picture.
Alabama scientist Roy W. Spencer has also denied the theory of evolution, replacing it with intelligent design and creationism, theories embraced by the deeply conservative Christian movement.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Here's the end of the talk by Professor Richard B. Alley of Penn State to the American Geophysical Union, December 2009 in San Francisco.
So where do we end up? We're gonna get out of here in a hurry. If higher CO2 warms, the Earth climate history makes sense. And if CO2 doesn't warm, we have to explain why the physicists are stupid, and we also have no way to explain what happened. And it's really that simple, okay? We don't have any plausible alternative to that at this point. And so it surely looks like it, you know? CO2 can be a forcing, it can be a feedback. The warming effect of a CO2 molecule, it does not remember why it's there. It only remembers that it is there. And the paleoclimate data show that sort of the mid-range models are right. And if there's a problem, the world is a little more sensitive to CO2 on some time scales than the models tend to produce. Now, be clear, there's lots of knobs that control the climate. The sun knob, we're really lucky, it doesn't get twiddled very much. The cosmic ray, the spaced out, the magnetic field, and the other knobs, if they matter, we can't find it yet. They're really interesting things to be learned, and I hope that the science rolls forward on those. But so far, they're either not doing anything or they're not doing much. They're fine-tuning knobs is how it looks. Okay? This is not a regional story. All right? You close the Isthmus of Panama and the people that used to have coastal property don't anymore. They're climate changed. You take India from the pole and you run it to the equator, it's climate changes, okay? The Unger Dryas was a big regional thing. There's lots of things in regional climate that don't do much to the globe. The Unger Dryas is cold in the north, it's warm in the south, it doesn't do much to the global temperature. In terms of the things that people care about, CO2 is just a start. It's not the end. There are real interesting things to be done in here, okay? And I think there's a lot more work that needs to be done here yet, because where we really stand now, we're not quite yet at that pound on the table, this is nailed, we're done, this is our confidence interval level. The paleoclimate data are coming in real fast, they're real good, it's really sharp, but sort of these latest advances have not had time to percolate through to the IPCC yet. And so we're going to see more on this. We're going to see more discussion on this. This story is very clearly not done. Okay? But it's fairly clear where we stand now, which would be an increasing body of science indicates CO2 has been the most important controller on the global average climate of the Earth. And so I thank you so much for inviting me, and I hope we can take a few questions, and thank you.
But what if we burn all the fossil fuels we can get our hands on? Richard Alley answers this question in the short Q&A session.
The question was, if we burn all the fossil fuels, where do we get to? And there's this huge gap between sort of proven reserves and what we think is probably out there if we're really clever and really desperate. And so do we get it out of the oil shales? Do we get it? And people are kicking around numbers like 5,000 or 6,000 gigatons, I think is the number. There's a big number that's floating around on what might be recoverable. And if you take all of that and you turn it to CO2 pretty fast, there's some chance of getting above that Cretaceous level. And like I say, that was now, the temperatures may have been a little high at that site because the Atlantic is a little narrower and so the ocean circulation has slowed a little bit, but that was 37, 38 sea surface temperature. That was hot. So you know, you start thinking about this and saying, well, you know, if we really crank it up, are we really confident we're topping at 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or, you know, you can think of a burn-it-all future getting really hot.
In other words, out-of-control global heating where the seas could reach 38 degrees Celsius or 100 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than the human body. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the 20th century average sea surface temperature was 16.4 degrees centigrade or 61.5 degrees Fahrenheit. If we burned up all the fossil fuels, it is conceivable the average sea temperature could more than double in Celsius or rise about 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Given what it takes to heat water, that kind of super record warming would presumably take at least centuries, if not millennia. But in our strange case of rapid emissions, we really don't know. Human fossil mining is an ahistorical event. Nothing in the natural record prepares us for this. Surely humans and the ecosystems which support humans would have gone extinct before that happens. Maybe not. The delay in warming caused by sea absorption, among other factors, means we could burn many gigatons of carbon before we see the horrible results a generation or two later. But then, that change can last at least 100,000 years, as shown by Dr. David Archer in his book, The Long Thaw. You can find our Radio EcoShock interview with him as well. But will we go to these extremes? Well, look, we're already doubling tar sands production. We're fracking gas shales. We're all drilling miles deep below the ocean all to get more fossil fuels. Right now, barring a vast revolution in our economy and our energy systems, we're headed into Thermageddon, as described by the late Greenpeace founder Robert Hunter. Top scientists know this, and they're deeply worried.
Are we, the pampered driving public, really the climate Nazis of history? To his dying day, Robert Hunter thought so, and said so, in his last book, Thermageddon, Countdown to 2030.
But wait, we didn't allow Dr. Alley to answer one of the biggest denier complaints, that the climate record often shows CO2 following a temperature rise. So how could CO2 cause climate change? That's why they want him fired, if not charged with crimes against humanity. Let's quickly dive into that.
Okay. Now, we're going to do the ice cores here briefly. This is the one that I'm supposed to be fired for. You'll remember that CO2 goes up and down, temperature goes up and down, and they sort of look like each other. But we know that the CO2 is not causing that. This is a fast Fourier transform of the temperature, and you'll notice that there's a peak here, and there's a peak here, and there's a couple peaks down here. And the position of those peaks was predicted 50 years before it was observed. And the predictions were this arrow from the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit, this arrow from the obliquity of the Earth's orbit, and these arrows from the precession of the Earth's orbit. There's no doubt that the ice ages are paced by the orbits. There's no way that the orbit knows to dial up CO2 and say change. The orbit has to change the ice sheets and other things that then have to change the CO2. And so it shouldn't be terribly surprising if the CO2 goes a little bit behind. Now remember the argument against me, CO2 lags Earth's temperature. This one scientific fact alone proves that CO2 is not the cause of the recent warming. Okay? In case, first of all, don't blame Penn State. I don't know what went wrong this time, but we do a good job. Okay? And in case you ever run into this one, and I have heard this one from important people in government as well, let me do something for you here that may prove useful if you have to discuss this out in public. There's no question CO2 and temperature have changed essentially together. The data are good. And there's not much doubt that at times the CO2 is a little bit behind the temperature by a few centuries. The temperature never goes very far without the CO2. The CO2 never goes very far without the temperature. But they're not perfectly together. Okay? So what I want you to do is think for a minute. I go out with my credit card and I'm doing Christmas shopping and I go into debt. Right? I overspend and I'm in debt. And so my credit card company is gleeful because now they can collect interest payments, and I go deeper into debt. Now, remember that interest lags debt. Now, this correspondent to my administration has said that because CO2 lags temperature, there is no possibility that CO2 can contribute to temperature. By the same brilliant logic, interest lags debt, so I never have to worry about the credit card company. They never can damage me. It's wonderful. Okay. Right up. Okay. Now, but you might ask the question, how do we know that interest contributes to debt? Well, first of all, if you try to, you go fundamentals of economics or bookkeeping, and they say, well, if I give money to the bank, they have my money. And if I don't have the money to begin with, I'm deeper in debt. And then you go and you try to build a little numerical model in your Excel spreadsheet, and you see if interest explains the debt, and it does. Right? So then you do this for climate, and we know that the orbits drive the warming that causes the CO2 rise, it causes more warming. The CO2 is lagging the warming. How do we know CO2 adds to the warming? Well, it's physics. And if we implement that physics in a climate model, it is necessary and sufficient to explain the warming. And let me walk through that a little bit here. Okay, so the ice ages are orbitally paced. There's virtually no globally average change in forcing. And yet there's a globally average response of 5 to 6 Celsius. Okay, what we find is when you turn down the sun in Canada in the summer, you grow ice. And the ice is reflective, and the ice grinds up rocks to make dust, and the ice changes the vegetation. Those affect the planetary albedo. And if you take a good climate model and you put in the maximum ice and the maximum dust and the maximum vegetation changes, you get about half of this cooling. And that's cheating, because you can't get the ice and the vegetation without changing the CO2 in the model. But at any rate, you only get about half. If you put in the greenhouse gases, and especially the CO2, you get the other half. And it actually agrees pretty nicely. And so this is the same as my bookkeeper that I don't have, trying to explain my debt to the credit card corporation. You look at the fundamentals, and then you look at a numerical implementation of the fundamentals and see if it quantitatively explains what happened. And we can't explain this without this.
My understanding of Dr. Alley's explanation is the same as he talked about at the end of his speech. CO2 can be a forcing. It can be a feedback. The warming effect of the CO2 molecule, it does not remember why it's there. It only remembers that it is there, end quote. When other lesser control knobs, like exploding chains of volcanoes or even the regular tilt in Earth's orbit, begin the process of warming, CO2 becomes an amplifying factor, which drives the planet into a much warmer state. That has happened many times. But now, and for the first time, a species on Earth has brought out CO2 accumulated over huge eras of time and burned it in a century or two. In this case, CO2 can be a forcing. That is, humans can trigger a great warming event, and it seems almost certain we have begun it now. Could we save ourselves by mimicking natural processes? So far, that doesn't look possible because things like rock weathering take thousands or tens of thousands of years. If we try to mine that just the right rock and grind it up and expose it to form calcium carbonate, the energy involved in the process of getting it might be greater and more carboniferous than the carbon removed. It is easier, Dr. Richard Alley says to applause, to prevent carbon from entering the atmosphere in the first place. In February of last year, Richard Alley shared the 2009 Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement with Ram Ramanathan for scientific contributions that advanced understanding of how human activities influence global climate and alter oceanic, glacial, and atmospheric phenomenon in ways that adversely affect planet Earth. Try to save myself, but myself keeps slipping away. Background music for this show is thanks to Nine Inch Nails Slipping Away. I'm Alex Smith. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. Find a transcript of this program with a few helpful links in my blog entry for January 7th, 2010. Feel free to download and share this program as an MP3 with others from our website, ecoshock.org. Pass the word around, and thank you so much for listening.